all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio. This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or by going to veteransradio.net, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to veteransradio.net. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to NVBDC.org. We also want to thank Eisenhower Center. It's a brain injury recovery center. Learn more about EisenhowerCenter.com. They're located in Michigan and in Florida. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at LegalHelpForVeterans.com. We want to thank VetBiz Central, which is part of the U.S. Small Business Association, VBOC, Vet Business Outreach Centers. VetBiz Central covers Michigan, Indiana, and Ohio, and can be reached at vetbizcentral.org. Let's move on to our programs. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today James Carl Nelson, who's an author and historian, and we're going to talk about his new book, The York Patrol. Jim, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks very much for having me.
No, it's great to have you on. We have a certain soft spot in our heart for Medal of Honor recipients, and every now and again it's good to reach back because there's so many of these, and this is we're going to talk about the real story of Alvin York and the unsung heroes who made him World War I's most famous soldier. This is one of those things that people probably have forgotten over time, but we're going to mention a few things, and they go, oh, yeah, I remember that. And it starts with sort of people remembering the movie. The Sergeant York movie with Cary Grant back when,
Walter Matthau.
Right. These are big, Hollywood names that have now passed on. But
it was Gary Cooper.
Oh, it was Gary Cooper.
Yeah. He won an Academy Award for that.
These are names that people have sort of forgotten, and a little bit they've forgotten who Alvin York was. So let's start with, tell us the background of Alvin York.
Well, he was, a backwoods Tennessee hick, really, and his family had been in Fentress County, Tennessee, in northeastern Tennessee for some generations, and he had basically, if you add it all together, he had about 2 years of proper schooling. He was kind of a hellraiser in his early days, went out and drank and got in fights and shot at people, and then he had to come to Jesus moment and found the Lord, and with the aegis of a local pastor who was sort of a fundamentalist church there, and he went on the straight and narrow. And then in 1917, his draft number came up, and so he was shipped to Camp Gordon in Georgia, and he really wrestled with the issue of he might have to kill a person, another man, if he goes in the army and goes to France and fights. And he really wrestled with it. He wasn't a real complicated guy. But this is one thing. I mean, that's like the first commandment, thou shalt not kill. And so they were really actually pretty nice to him, considering it was the army back in 1917. They let him, they tried to hash it out with him, his commanding officers, trading verses back and forth about why he should pick up a gun and why he shouldn't. They let him go home for 10 days to think about it. And he walked in the mountains. And finally, you know, he was kind of painted as a conscientious objector, which wasn't really true, but that's his pastor, Rosier Pike, tried to have him labeled such named such in some letters that he sent. York always said he wasn't that. He just wanted to know what the fighting was all about. So he finally got convinced himself that it would be okay for him to pick up a weapon and use it against fellow man for a greater good, whatever you want to call it. And so he went back to Camp Gordon and then got shipped overseas with the 82nd Division.
Well, this early years is sort of interesting because, as you say, he was a backwoods Tennessee, grew up in the holla, hick. But that also meant he had a certain skill set that he developed over time that translated pretty well to the Army, didn't it?
Yeah, well, his father was quite a hunter, and he always took Alvin out hunting, whatever, birds, bear, whatever. So, yeah, he was really adept with the rifle, you know, sort of probably a musket-style rifle. Became a good shot, legendarily good shot. I mean, I know they played that up in the movie big time when he shoots the head off a turkey, but they did have, like, turkey shoots and things like that where you would, you know, win money or win a bird or something if you got the best shot on it. So, yeah, that was a skill set. And also just being roaming the woods, you know, being at home in the woods, hunting, trapping, whatever it was. That certainly came into play in France because they went over some pretty rough ground in that fight, and especially when they went into the Argonne Forest where he performed his famous deed.
Well, and one of the things that, again, it's kind of easy to forget about what World War One was really like. You know, those aren't the current movies. That's not currently in the media. But these were boys. Many of them had not been, you know, 100 miles from their hometown, and they find themselves moving around the United States, being put on a ship and sent over to England and then over to Europe. This was a real awakening for these guys, wasn't it?
For the Americans, you know, my grandfather was a Swedish immigrant who got drafted and went back to France and got shot at Soissons. But so for him, it was like he's going back. He's a little more worldly. Came from Sweden. But for somebody like Alvin York, he'd never left Tennessee. And so when he went to Camp Gordon, that's the first time he'd ever really been out of the county. And so, yeah, to go to France and first to England, I'll take the train, go to Hoboken, see New York City, go across, you know, and then you go across England. It's not like they sent anybody right to Paris, but he eventually got to Paris. And in York's case, it really did open his eyes. He saw, you know, big cities and he saw different kinds of people, and it widened his mind to a larger degree so that when he got back to the States, he resolved to improve the lives of the people in this backwoods community that he was living in. He wanted to build schools, get the kids educated, you know, just because he had seen that in France and in England, you know.
And World War One in particular was as all wars are, a brutal war.
It was the classic, the trenches, sending, you know, battalions on full frontal charges against machine gun positions. It was sort of like life was very cheap on all sides. The United States didn't get in until April of 1917. Didn't really get fighting until really, you know, April, May of 1918. But, you know, they lost 53,000 men killed in action or to wounds. A total of 116,000 men died in 6 months. If you multiply that times eight, it would have been a pretty staggering number, probably close to a million casualties. It was a tough war, and Germany was, until the end, a tough foe.
And you mentioned it was these frontal attacks. This isn't where, you know, you send in the bombers to soften up the hillside. This was a different war, and that sort of sets up this push through the Argonne Forest in I guess I'll call it northeast France, the Western Front. that results in Alvin York's, you know, day of infamy. He's been in Europe for about, 4 or 5 months at that point. They're not really all that battle tested.
No.
Walk us through what happens with York's patrol and how they come to this unique situation.
Yeah, in the larger context, the Argonne offensive pushed off on, I think, September 25th, 1918, and they were jumping off, heading north, 9 American divisions against the German defenders. And in the sector that York wound up in, it was it started out with the 35th Division, and they made good progress, then got stymied at a village called Exermont, just south of the Romaine Hills. The 1st Division took over. They were able to take Hill 240, keep pushing a little bit more, but then they got stymied by artillery from across the Aire River to the northwest that halted their progress. So a plan was devised. It was a pretty risky plan, too, to send another division below the 1st Division west and above the 28th Division that was moving up the west side of the Aire. And so they did like this maneuver where they just sent them straight west across the air, started trying to clean out the hills of Cornay and Châtel-Chéry. They made some fairly decent progress. The 1st Battalion of the 328th Regiment and the 327th to their north, but it was bitter fighting. And on the morning of October 8th, they decided to send in the 2nd Battalion of the 328th Regiment, and that is Alvin York's battalion, and continued to push west. They're trying to reach this railroad track called the Dachauville Railroad that supplied that entire area, the German army in that area. Another complicating factor was further to the west in the 77th Division sector, there was the famous Lost Battalion, who were surrounded by Germans. They had been cut off from the rest of their men, and they were being attacked with flamethrowers and grenades, and they were in terrible straits. So part of the move was also intended to alleviate the pressure around the Lost Battalion. So 6 a.m. on October 8th in the morning, the 2nd Battalion of 328th picks up the fight west. They run into horrendous machine gun fire coming from their front and from their left. The platoon that York and his mates were in, its leader, Lieutenant Kirby Stewart, was killed during the advance. And finally, Sergeant Harry Parsons takes over, and he gathers Bernard Early, who's the sergeant of this squad, what do you want to call it, and he instructs them to go to the left over a hill and try to reduce the machine guns on the left that are causing so much damage. And so there were 17 men, and York was one of them. He was a squad leader, one of four. And they went up this hill, back down around. They didn't even really know where they were. Eventually, they realized they were behind the German lines, and they encountered a couple of German medics at a stream. They fired at them. The medics took off running and basically led them right to this group of German soldiers who were lolling about eating breakfast in preparation for going into battle.
This is almost accidental, isn't it? It is they get behind enemy lines and stumble on this encampment of guys who mm-hmm. who weren't prepared to fight. They, as you say, it was breakfast time.
It was mutual surprise, I would say. You know, the Americans were surprised. The Germans were surprised. The Germans actually thought they were British soldiers. You know, I don't think the Germans really even at that point realized that the Americans were coming in full force at them. But yeah, so they had laid their weapons aside. To some of the Americans in the patrol start firing. The Germans have no idea how big a force this is. They could, for all they know, it's hundreds of people. Bernard Early instructs them to surrender. The German commander does. He speaks English because he spent some time in the States. And so he tells men in the patrol to go start taking the weapons from the Germans and lining them up to get them out of there. And unknown, on a ridge just above them in the woods, the Germans who had been firing out of the open plain on Hill 223 at the advancing Americans turned the guns around and fired down hitting some of the Germans, but killing instantly six members of the patrol. It was kind of, you could say they should have known better. They should have reconnoitered better, but I think everything happened really quickly. Three men were also wounded, Bernard Early, Otis Merrithew, and Muzzy. So what do the men do? The Germans hit the ground. The men are still there guarding them, basically. Everybody hits the ground and tries to stay out of sight. I mean, they're just eating dirt, you know. And York wound up in a favorable position, sort of in the center and a little forward, and it was protected by some brush and trees and also a gaggle of German soldiers that he had been guarding. So he used them as cover, and he would say that whenever he saw a German machine gunner or whatever pop up his head up, he just tetched him off with his rifle first. It said he killed 20, 25. I know some of the other men were also firing. Percy Beardsley, we had this French light machine gun called a Shosho, which is usually handled by three men. He also said he fired his pistol. We still don't know exactly how many, but the noumen of the fight, the end of the fight, is when this lieutenant, Fritz Endres, gathers six of his men and comes streaming down the hill in a bayonet charge, basically, pretty much right for York's position. And he takes out his pistol and he begins firing, and he starts with the guys at the back so that if they fired the guys in the front, they know to hit the ground because they could see the guys fall. Starts shooting from left to right at the guys coming down the hill, and his last shot mortally wounds Fritz Endres, shot in the stomach. And at that point, the German commander, who meanwhile had his own pistol and was trying to shoot York and missed all six shots, finally says, comes up to York and says, if you stop shooting, I'll surrender. And York says, okay. And he says, what are you guys, English? He says, no, I'm American. He goes, oh, my God. And so, his name was Vollmer, and I think it was Kurt Vollmer. And anyway, he didn't know how many Americans were there. So he surrendered about 90 of his men. And once again, they start, taking weapons, lining them up, and then they start marching them out.
And this is the, this all happens in the matter of, 15 minutes or something.
10, 15, yeah,
yeah,
pretty quick.
It's yeah. Really a quick event, which many firefights are, mm-hmm. particularly at that point in time. And because Lieutenant Vollmer surrenders, not knowing how big a group of Americans are surrounding him, 90, 100 people get captured, and York is now in charge of the platoon, and has to march these guys back to the American side, and turn these guys all in. And one of the things, the book is really well written and easy to read, The York Patrol, The Real Story of Alvin York and the Unsung Heroes Who Made Him World War I's Most Famous Soldier by James Carl Nelson. And the maps are good to help you kind of understand what's going on. But from a historian's standpoint, the next part is what's fascinating, I think, probably to the reader and maybe to you, about how this kind of gets a life of its own. He becomes put up for a Distinguished Service Cross, okay, but then there's the media involvement, which back in the day, people, was newspapers and magazines, not the internet. Talk us through how this kind of catches on and becomes this promotion of America's hero of World War I.
Well, word got around within army circles of what had happened when they marched these Germans back out on the plane to the 328th headquarters. And slowly word got around more and more when York and the others brought this big group of Germans, and other Germans that had been captured by the rest of Company G and Company E were also added to the total. So it came to about 132 Germans. Marched them back to the headquarters of the 164th Brigade, and its commander, says, York, I hear you captured the whole German army. And York says, no, I only got 132. Anyway, York gets around. And there was the biggest impetus for his becoming a legend was a writer named George Patullo, who had been in France for about a year and a half and had written different stories about the 1st Division and then about Belleau Wood. He heads to France after the war was over. One more time, he had gone to the U.S. briefly for a visit. And he gets wind of this story, and he basically gets, you know, who doesn't want, you know, somebody to be a hero in their, under their command? By now, York already had been recommended for a Medal of Honor once they figured out the magnitude of his feat. And so he interviews York and other members of the patrol and writes the story for the Saturday Evening Post called The Second Elder Gives Battle, referring back to his Christian beliefs, his membership of the church. And that was a big splash. And that ran on April 26, 1919, before York even got back to the U.S. That got picked up by other newspapers. He became not just a national celebrity, but an international celebrity. I mean, he was one of the most famous people in the world at that point. And for really much of the rest of his life, he lived to be, I think, was he about 76 when he died in 1964. It started slowly waned a little bit more, but he's always in the news. I mean, during World War II, somebody ghostwrited a newspaper column for him. And then, of course, the movie came along in 1941. There's a lot of patriotic stuff going on about the brewing World War II. But it really gave itself a life of its own. And York, though, you know, he was deluged with movie offers, books offers, all sorts of things. And for 10 years, he didn't do anything. He said the uniform's not for sale. But he had this big idea to build schools in Fentress County. He was trying to raise money for that. Local Rotary Club had given him a farm and paid for only half of it. So he was left with this mortgage that he was basically going to be foreclosed upon. And he finally realized that he was terrible with money, by the way. Finally realized maybe he should, try to capitalize on his fame, if nothing else, to help his projects, these schools and things like that.
Well, I think that's where, as we come up on time limits here, I want to point out a couple of things that I got out of reading the book, and I recommend it to everybody. You point out that he becomes the hero, and I'm quoting from the book that says, York happened to ride into a fuller fame than most of his brother Medal of Honor men because an American magazine writer gave the world the story of his deed at the moment when the public was seeking just such a war idol. And then I want to spring forward to 1940s or 41, whatever it is, when the movie comes out and Sergeant York, the movie comes out. Again, a whole new media buzz, if you will, because America was looking for a new war hero or, refanning the flames as they were looking at going into World War II. Did you intend to draw that comparison, or am I just overreading it?
No, not at all. In fact, I mean, when the movie came out, I think it was in over the summer of 41, before Pearl Harbor, there were young men go see that movie and go down to the enlistment office and join in. So it was, and that was part of the intent of the movie. That's why there's a lot of newspapers saying this is really great. We need some patriotism right now. And you're right. One of the things was that, I note in the beginning of the book that there were 13 different American soldiers performed actions on October 8, 1918, and were awarded the Medal of Honor. Why York? And I think the answer is his deed was indeed special, but because of his backstory, because George Patullo came along and wrote him up. I mentioned in there, in the book that there's a Sergeant Harry Adams with the 89th Division. He shot through a door and followed some Germans through, and he walked out with 300 men and he had an unloaded weapon, and 300 Germans surrendered to him. So it wasn't just sheer numbers. It was everything combined, the timing, the need for a hero, maybe even the need for someone to say what this war was really all about. Because it really didn't resolve anything.
The other thing that you really point out in the book, and I think it's an important lesson for everybody, is just because you have that one heroic day and you get put up on the pedestal for it. Yeah, he was terrible with money. He had not only bad luck but bad decisions on almost everything after the war, because he wasn't an educated man, and he was put in this spot of having to deal with offers and whatnot and book deals and it was more than he could handle, and yet we continue to hold those heroes up and sometimes knock them down when they don't meet our expectations.
Yeah, and I mean he didn't pay the taxes he owed from his receipts from the movie, which was a significant amount of money. He owed the IRS into the 50s until finally they settled, like he's worth $25,000 at that point or something, and he gave it all to the government, and they said, okay, we're even now. You know, and when he died, he was living off of $300 stipend from a wealthy businessman. I mean, it was like he didn't make a lot of money off of his deed. If you get it in my book, I think it's almost kind of like, be careful what you wish for. And I don't think he wished for this anyway.
It
was kind of what was thrust on him. He had no idea leaving the forest that day what was going to become of his life. He couldn't have.
And the whole point of the York Patrol is to give some, put out some information about all the other men who survived or died.
Too. He couldn't have done it without him. I mean, if they hadn't been there to help him kill these Germans, and also to guard the prisoners that they were, while they were under fire, that could have just rushed them if they had wanted to, and could have just annihilated the whole patrol. My first book was Remains of Company D, about my grandfather's unit. I just wanted to say who these guys were. You know, there was like half a dozen immigrants from Poland, Russia, Ireland, a real typical kind of doughboy kind of squad. I want to mention one more thing, too. People don't really get that this action, this capture of these Germans here on the right flank of the German line, actually was a huge turning point in the Argonne fight and then in the war, which ended a month later. They allowed their comrades to keep pushing forward west to the railway line. They cut that off. This is on October 8th. On October 9th, the Germans started pulling out from the Argonne. Because they moved their right flank back. So it was really, it's more important than just the capture of these 90 whatever Germans. It had a big impact on the war itself.
Let me finish by reading sort of a last few sentences that really struck me in the book, because it is about not just York, it's about the other men too. Quote, both the quick and the dead should be remembered and honored when talk turns to Acting Corporal Alvin C. York. Each did their duty and plowed into the deep woods on the left flank of their regiment's advance into the Argonne Forest, some paying the ultimate price. Remember their names and their sacrifice. But remember Alvin York as well, the man who performed his duty with steely determination and skill and paid for it one way or another for the rest of his life.
Yeah, I guess that's my point. You know, I really kind of believe that he might have had a happier life. He had just gone back to Tennessee unknown, and just lived in anonymity like, so many doughboys did, so many returning soldiers of all wars did. My grandfather did. He was a painting contractor in Chicago. I mean, it's a question that occurred to me when I was doing the book.
Well, I want to thank you for your work. It's a great read. It really shines a light on a particular event and a particular Medal of Honor recipient, and we're glad to bring James Carl Nelson, author and historian, who wrote The York Patrol, to our veteran radio listeners. Jim, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Thanks so much for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Veterans Radio needs you. If you like our shows that are informative, surprising stories, and relevant information on what's happening at the VA and the military, we'd like your support. Individual support of $5 to $50 a month or corporate sponsorship of $1,000 to $10,000 would be welcomed. You can go to veteransradio.net, click on the sponsorship or support tab, pay online, and keep Veterans Radio on the air.
Bigger is better. Hey, Detroit. It's me, Tanya Lalonde, from Summit Place Kia, the biggest Kia dealerships in Michigan. We sell more, so you save more. We have hundreds of new Kias in stock for $269 per month and under. Credit score less than perfect? Our lenders can get you approved. So come see me, Tanya Lalonde, today at Summit Place Kia in Clinton Township and Summit Place Kia in Auburn Hills or at summitplacekia.com.
24-month leases, $34.95 US signing plus tax, title, license, stock, and acquisition fee. No security deposit, subject to lender approval, expires month end.
You should be driving a Kia from Summit Place Kia. Summit Place Kia.